Let's go ahead and get started. I think I know most of you know who I am, but for those of you who don't, my name is Chad Pecron. Along with Zach Mayo, we're the co-chairs of the Little Rock Lawyers Chapter for the Federalist Society. And I'd like to thank you all for coming today. Before we turn it over to today's speaker, I'd like to tell you a little bit about our next event because we're very excited about it. On December 14th at noon, we will be hosting a presentation virtual again, of course, with Judge Radofsky, who's also graced us here today, and also two of his new colleagues on the federal bench, Judge Steve Seeger from the Northern District of Illinois, and Judge Brian Bisher from the District of Nebraska. And the three judges have each took very different routes to get to the bench, and we're going to have a talk among the three of them about how their different paths to the bench may or may not have affected their judging so far. So information about that will be coming out in the very near future, and I hope many of you can attend. That'll be a great event that we're co-hosting with the Chicago and the Nebraska chapters. But on to today's event, we're very pleased to have Dan McLaughlin here today. I've known Dan for a long time. We were both at Sidley Austin together several years ago. Dan stayed a lot longer than I did, but Dan is now a senior writer at National Review Online. He graduated from Holy Cross and received his JD from Harvard Law School. As I mentioned, he was at Sidley Austin for 23 years, where he practiced securities and commercial litigation in New York. Dan left private practice in March of this year to become a full-time senior writer for National Review. But that's far from the beginning of his writing career. Over the years, Dan has been a contributing editor of Red State, a columnist at The Federalist and The New Ledger, a baseball blogger at baseballcrank.com, bostonsportsguy.com, The Providence Journal Online, and a contributor to The Command Post. If you all don't follow Dan at his Twitter feed at Baseball Crank, you're really missing out. He brings a unique and interesting perspective to many areas, both law and outside the law. His writings on politics, baseball, and the law have appeared in numerous newspapers, magazines, websites, and legal journals, other than what I've already mentioned. Today, he's here to talk about Supreme Court nominations and the perils of court packing, which is a very timely topic. And with that, I'll turn it over to my friend, Dan McLaughlin.
Thanks, Chad. Yeah, I'm glad to be here. It's one of the mixed blessings of our era that on the one hand, it is easy enough for us to join together from our own homes. But on the other hand, that speaking to groups like this, I don't actually get to travel and see folks in person. So glad to be with you all virtually in that respect. Court packing has been pretty intensely, I think, in the news down the stretch. It, for those of us who are following carefully, the issue really arose in the beginning of the Democratic primary in what seems like another world now. Back in February 2019, when Pete Buttigieg proposed a what he called a court reform scheme, which was somewhat complicated, but it basically involved expanding the court to 15 justices over time, and doing so, there was fairly complicated scheming to it, to the proposal, but it essentially amounted to the idea that the court in its current existence was broken and that it needed to be reformed by giving the future presidents the ability to add more justices. That proposal rocketed Buttigieg into national attention. He had been essentially an obscure mayor before then, at the back of a 20-some-odd candidate field, and really put it on the agenda, and a number of the other Democratic candidates expressed interest in it, most in various forms of it. Most notably, for our current purposes, Kamala Harris, who, of course, will now become the vice president. And so at the time, you had some criticism of this from other Democratic candidates, notably Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders. Sanders took a bit of a middle position. He was critical of the he proposed his own sort of halfway solution, but both he and Biden criticized the idea of court packing at the time in 2019 on the grounds that it would set off a round of mutual escalations by both parties. this was not well received by the activist base of the Democratic Party, which at the time was expecting both to steamroll Biden out of the way and to win the presidency with a significant majority in both houses of Congress. As we know now, neither of those things happened. The issue, however, remains a live one. Biden, during the general election campaign, declined to say for a long time whether or not he stuck to his consistent position that he's had against court packing, which goes all the way back to the 1980s. He was against it even in 1987. He finally, under a certain amount of pressure, came out and said, well, he was going to kick the issue down the road, appoint a judicial reform commission that would study the issue for 6 months and report back. And this is probably a way of keeping the issue at least somewhat alive to the people who want it without actually getting in Biden's way. But the question remains undecided. And frankly, one reason I think he wanted to kick the can down the road was that he did not know, in addition to his own electoral considerations, he did not know whether he would be coming into office with a Democratic-controlled Senate or not. And at this point, we still don't know that. Republicans will have 50 senators in the next Senate, at least, and possibly 51 or 52, depending on the runoffs January 5th in Georgia. Certainly are some of the Democrats in the Senate who have said that they would not go along. How long that resistance remains, Joe Manchin in particular in West Virginia, how long that resistance remains to be seen. And so I think it will probably be yet again a live issue in the Georgia Senate runoffs. Now, when I talk about court packing, one of the things that is sort of surprising to me, but maybe shouldn't be, is that, you know, particularly if you get into Twitter arguments and the like, you immediately run into people saying, well, you know, Donald Trump has packed the courts. And this is surprising to me because at least when I went to grammar school, we learned all about Franklin D. Roosevelt's court packing plan, and it was simply understood that everybody knew what court packing meant. And perhaps, as is often the term, often the case when words stand for ideas with a history, and those words are an obstacle, a political obstacle, people try to change their meaning. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to use the definition that I grew up with, the court packing, which is expanding the size of a court or changing the tenure of its judges or how they are appointed in order to affect ideological outcomes, essentially in order to not for some other, not for some other practical reason, but for the specific and open goal of changing the court's rulings. Now, unlike some other things in the area of constitutional fights and constitutional adjudication, there is not perhaps surprisingly, not a rule in the Constitution about court packing. The Constitution says that there will be one Supreme Court. It says that federal judges will serve during good behavior, which has been quite reasonably interpreted to mean life tenure. But other than that, the Constitution is surprisingly silent. It doesn't say how many justices will be on the court. It doesn't say anything about there being any other federal courts other than the Supreme Court, except that Congress can create them. And so fights over court packing are fights over what the court can do to the Constitution rather than what the Constitution says about the court. There are essentially three problems from my perspective with court packing, and I think that should be widely shared. The first is judicial independence. Judicial independence is really the cornerstone of what the court system exists for, particularly the federal court system. You know, there has actually been in recent years, and not only in recent years, a number of expansions of state courts, including state Supreme Courts. But the state courts are different. State courts are often far more political actors than the federal courts. And the reason we have a federal court system is because the state courts are expected to be more political actors. In Arizona, for example, they expanded the state Supreme Court from five justices to seven in 2016. And that was actually something that had been an idea that had been kicking around the state long enough that they actually, when they built the courthouse, they had designed it for seven justices. So, you know, Arizona was trying to get itself in line with longstanding expectations. But to pick that as a contrast, in Arizona, the justices must face retention elections. They have age limits at age 70. The governor faces some limits on who he can appoint because he has to run his nominations through a commission. And state courts vary across the country. Many of them have elected justices or retention elections. The whole concept, though, of and particularly if you go back and read Alexander Hamilton in Federalist Number 78, where he talks at a good deal of length about the importance of judicial independence and really lays out the theory of judicial review and why he expected that it was so important that judges have an unflinching dedication to the individual rights in the document, which is interesting, of course, because he's writing this before the Bill of Rights, but he was talking about things like the ex post facto clause and the other handful of explicit protections for individual rights in the Constitution. And so he tied it all the way to the beginning to the idea that judicial review had to come with judicial independence and that the federal courts had to exist as a specific protection against local interests. The second reason why court packing is a bad idea, in addition to the threat to judicial independence that can come with expanding the court, not only expanding the court, but threatening to expand the court, right? The court can be intimidated, as we have sometimes seen, by threats to expand it. And in fact, expanding a court also creates the problem that you have when there are simply too many justices on the court who are appointed by the current president. Now, we've had certainly presidents who served for 8 years who got to nominate three justices, as President Trump has, four justices, as Benjamin Harrison did in his one term. But we have not had, except for Franklin Roosevelt, who served, who served more than three terms, a president who was able to appoint such a predominating number of the justices. And I think perhaps the extreme example of where the danger to that comes in excessive deference of the court, not only to a particular ideology, but to a particular serving president, would be the Korematsu case, in which eight of the nine justices who heard that case involving Japanese internment, internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, had been appointed by Roosevelt. Many of them had been in Roosevelt's Justice Department. Owen Roberts, the lone Republican on the court, dissented. Some of FDR's appointees did too. But ultimately, the court upheld very, very broad powers of the presidency. And it's hard to separate that from the fact that they were all FDR loyalists. So the second, after judicial independence, the second reason is that our system of law does require respect for norms, not only for laws, that norms underlie, a rule of law system requires respect for judicial rulings, for example, a certain amount of respect for precedent. And to disregard the norms that exist in the construction of the court itself really opens us up towards a path to essentially a banana republic system in which the law itself, written law, is treated with a certain amount of contempt. When we get into the issue of, which I'll talk about in a minute, how the Senate has handled confirmation of Supreme Court justices, there is a critical difference here that the Senate over the year, the presidency and the Senate over the years have pushed the envelope a bit with what are the norms of confirming justices, what are the norms of appointing justices. And those are sort of within the white lines, as you will, of the basic rules, the constitutional structure that the president appoints whoever he wants, and then the Senate confirms only whoever of those they want. But changing the size of the court is a drastically different step. because it changes the rules. Among other things, it changes the rules that the voters live by, right? Because the court has been set at 9 justices since 1869, the voters in national elections, in which the court and its rulings have assumed an ever greater power over an ever expanding list of issues. Anything from speech to guns to abortion to marriage, to the president's power to lock people up and kick people out of the country. So the courts have expanded in power, and the voters have gone to the polls year in and year out in presidential and Senate elections, knowing what the rules are. 9 justices, life tenure, you get to replace when the justices choose to step down. And so to break that fundamental bargain, I think, is a particularly dangerous one, and one that could lead to a lot less willingness of the voters and the people they elect to actually obey court rulings. And there are certainly those among conservatives who have been arguing for years that we should do less to have a system of total federal judicial supremacy. And there's something to be said for that, but I think that takes us down another road that is dangerous, and dangerous to conservatives and liberals alike, and to libertarians. So it holds dangers for a lot of different directions. The third reason I think to consider court packing dangerous is because of the very issue that both Biden and Sanders identified during the campaign, which is the potential to set off a cycle of retributions. Once you break the norm against expanding the court for strictly ideological purposes, you can always head further down that road where each successive time that a party gains control of both the presidency and Congress at the same time, it can add as many justices as it likes. And one runs the risk of a Supreme Court that looks like the New Hampshire legislature or an Athenian town assembly. And nobody really wants that, ultimately. I mean, the quality of the court's work, unlike all the other branches of government, the quality of the court's work is fundamentally an intellectual project as much as an exercise of popular sovereignty. And the quality of that, I think, would deteriorate if you had a massive expansion of the size of the court in a fairly short period of time. Now, on the question of norms, you know, I'll go back a little bit further to how we got to a 9-member court. But, one of the things about norms, I mean, as I've said as I've written about this a bit in the judicial nomination area, you know, the question you fundamentally ask in politics is first, is there power? And then is there some norm, some reason to constrain that power? And I think in the area of court packing, we in fact have a fairly strong precedent against it. And that is Franklin Roosevelt's 1937 proposal. It's important to recognize FDR was elected re-elected in a landslide in 1936. He had the wind at his back. He had a 74-19 majority in the Senate, Democrats. And so he was at a point when he could do almost anything he wanted, or so he thought. At the same time, I think a lot of Americans were a little bit nervous in 1937 at the scope of FDR's powers. You have to remember, in 1937, Hitler is on the march in Germany. Mussolini is riding high in Italy. Stalin is at the head of his purges in Russia. And all across Europe, really, there is a rising tide of government authoritarianism, Japan as well. And I think there was a certain sentiment that FDR had been elected in part to take the country to the left economically, but also to do so in a way that would preserve the system, that would save us from socialism, save us from authoritarianism. And there was a little bit of concern afoot in the country in 1937. This is the high watermark of government authoritarianism around the world. And so, you know, FDR had not campaigned on court packing. He had not made it part. There are people who were urging him to do this in 1936, and he wouldn't. But so in the spring of 1937, continuing to be angry at, you know, a handful of conservatives, older conservatives on the court, standing in the way of his proposals, FDR unrolls his plan to expand one new justice for each existing justice over the age of 70. Now, FDR marketed this, at least on its face, as in part a matter of, well, the justices are getting old, they can't really handle their workload, all of which was nonsense, and the public saw it as nonsense. It didn't fool anybody. Congress, journalists, everybody simply treated this as an obviously ideological project, even its supporters. And not only that, but FDR, it's also important not to forget the fact that what was particularly radical here is that FDR was not just mad at the court for rulings that went against him. He was mad at the court for sticking to precedent, for sticking to the Constitution as written. This was not merely a move against an activist court that was running far afield, although, you know, certainly some of the Lochner era doctrines that by that point had been in use for three decades or more, some of them were, in fact, very much activist rulings. But fundamentally, what FDR was pushing back against was precedent, was existing long-standing interpretations of the Constitution. He rolls out his proposal in February of 1937, and the immediate reaction was more or less horror. Congressional Democrats were horrified. The press was horrified. Gallup's polls, which had been which had fairly accurately predicted FDR's landslide victory, so they were reasonably accurate at the time, found that voters were opposed to court packing by a margin almost as large as the margin that FDR had just won by. And you read some of the things that the congressional Democrats, FDR's own allies, wrote at the time, and they were quite shocked. Edward Cox, the chairman of the House Rules Committee, said that this would enable him, through willing appointees, to change the meaning of our basic laws and our whole system of government. It asks for something which no man in this world ought to enjoy. The recommendation constitutes the most terrible threat to constitutional government that has arisen in the entire history of the country. That was the head of the House Rules Committee. The Senate Judiciary Committee liked it even less. It issued a report saying the court packing was a declaration that when the court stands in the way of a legislative enactment, the Congress may reverse the ruling by enlarging the court. When such a principle is adopted, our constitutional system is overthrown. Described it as a measure which should be so emphatically rejected that its parallel will never again be presented to the free representatives of the free people of America. And the report had this ringing declaration: let us now set a salutary precedent that will never be violated. Let us of the 75th Congress, in words that will never be disregarded by any succeeding Congress, declare that we would rather have an independent court, a fearless court, a court that will dare to announce its honest opinions in what it believes to be the defense of liberties of the people, than a court that, out of fear or a sense of obligation to the appointing power or factional passion, approves any measure we may enact. And that really did enter the history books as the fairly unanimous view of court packing for a very long time. Joe Biden himself in 2005, during fight over the over whether or not to eliminate the filibuster for judicial nominees at the appellate level, which ultimately ended up happening years later. Biden gave this whole speech, and he says, "Roosevelt, I remember this old adage about power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. He was corrupted by power, in my view. He unveiled his court packing plan." And Biden goes on, you can look it up in that speech, to talk about how important it is to Senate norms and Senate respect for the Constitution and institutional courage to stand against any future court packing plan. Unfortunately, as it turned out, however, even though the court packing plan collapsed, the intimidation may have worked. On March 29th, 1937, the Supreme Court decided West Coast Hotel versus Parrish, the so-called switch in time that saved nine, in which Justice Roberts, Owen Roberts, basically allowed himself to be bullied into changing his view on some of the issues of economic power that underlay the court's resistance to the New Deal. And there's historians continue to debate whether and to what extent Roberts had already been turning in that direction, that perhaps he was also reading the election tea leaves of FDR's massive landslide. But one way or another, even though FDR did not get what he planned, he got what he wanted. Three of the justices were gone by 1938. By 1941, seven of them were gone. When Roberts resigned in July 1945, Harry Truman got to appoint a Democrat and thus had a 9-member Democratic Supreme Court. You know, what we see is from the history there is that there really was the people of 1937 understood not only that they were shooting down a court packing proposal for the present time, but that they were doing so in a way that they wanted to be read, understood, and followed throughout American history. They laid down a marker, and I think that marker is one that is still valuable to follow. And it's valuable at a time when the judiciary is under a certain amount of threat of intimidation and jawboning from the chief executive. We had, of course, President Obama chewing out the justices in his State of the Union in 2010 over the Citizens United case, and he continued to sort of rattle the saber at the court in various ways during the Obamacare cases. President Trump, certainly during the travel ban cases early in his term, was at times going very hard after individual judges. Of course, we recall him doing this during his 2016 campaign as well. In 2019, you had five U.S. senators led by Sheldon Whitehouse writing an amicus brief in a Second Amendment case, basically openly threatening the court with court packing if it continued to enforce the Second Amendment. In 2020, we may already have forgotten this, but during the impeachment proceedings, Chief Justice Roberts is presiding over the president's impeachment, and Elizabeth Warren hands up a question to ask. Of course, under the procedures of impeachment, the Chief Justice has to read all the questions, and so he was forced to read aloud a question asking, at a time when large majorities of Americans have lost faith in government, does the fact that the Chief Justice is presiding over an impeachment trial in which Republican senators have thus far refused to allow witnesses or evidence, does this contribute to a loss of legitimacy of the Chief Justice, the Supreme Court, and the Constitution? And so, you know, there is this political straining at the edges in an attempt to get the justices, in whatever context they're sitting in, to bend in the way of political pressure. And I think that the threat, an open threat of court packing, is something that is likely to lead to more of that. Now, one of the chief arguments that proponents of court packing have made is essentially that the system of Senate confirmation has broken down irreparably, as symbolized by Republicans refusing to seat a justice in 2016. During an election year, and then turning around and seating a new justice in 2020 in an election year. And the simple answer to that is that precedent, in fact, first of all, as far as power is concerned, presidents can nominate whenever they want. Essentially, every president who has ever had an opportunity to make a Supreme Court nomination has done so. There have been 29 of those incidents either in an election year before an election or in a lame duck session after an election. On all 29 occasions, the president has made a nomination. Washington did it, Adams did it, Jefferson did it, Lincoln did it, FDR did it. And so there's an extraordinary, presidents are not constrained by norms here. The real issue is, what are the Senate norms? And I think if you look at the history, you will also find, and perhaps this is not a norm in favor of doing what the Republicans in the Senate did, but at a minimum, it is a precedent that supports what they did and shows that there is no norm constraining them from doing what they wanted to do. So if you look at those 29 nominations that have been made all the way back to 1792, in 17 out of 19 cases, or rather in 19 of the 29 cases, the Senate was controlled by the president's party. And in 17 of 19 of those, the president got a nomination through, 9 out of 10 of them before the election, and 9 out of 9 in lame duck sessions. It's 8 out of 10 before the election, sorry. The one exception that was actually stopped politically was the nomination of Homer Thornberry to the court in 1968, which was coupled with the elevation of Justice Fortas to the chief justiceship. And that was stopped by a bipartisan filibuster, in large part over concerns over cronyism and the ethics of Justice Fortas, although there was an ideological edge to that. It was largely an alliance of conservative Southern Democrats with Republicans pushing back against the Warren Court at the time of the resignation of Earl Warren. And they succeeded in keeping one seat on the court open for Richard Nixon to fill, and as it turned out, a second one as well when Fortas was compelled to resign in disgrace shortly thereafter. The only other one out of the 19 cases in which a president did not get his nominee through before the end of his term was when George Washington made a nomination that was constitutionally ineligible. He actually nominated one of the authors of the Judiciary Act itself, and it was pointed out to Washington that he could not take his seat during the term of the same Congress that had created the court. And Washington, with characteristic humility, admitted his error, withdrew his nominee, and resubmitted him in the new Congress when he was immediately confirmed. And if you look at the lame duck nominations, in fact, when the president and the senator from the same party, you have three of those, in fact, that were done in a lame duck session after the president lost the election. The most famous of those, of course, is John Adams' nomination of Chief Justice Marshall, John Marshall, in December of 1800. There were also lame duck nominations made by Martin Van Buren and Benjamin Harrison after they had lost the election, and those nominations were confirmed. And there's been some other, besides Marshall, there have been some other greatly distinguished justices who were nominated and confirmed in those situations, including Salmon P. Chase, who was put on the court in December of 1864 by Abraham Lincoln, and as well as Louis Brandeis and Benjamin Cardozo, also both election year nominees. Now, on the other hand, if you look at the 10 instances in which a president has made an election year or a lame duck nomination when the Senate was from the opposing party, Only one of those, Melville Fuller, the Chief Justice appointed by Grover Cleveland in 1888, only one of those was confirmed before the election. And in fact, Fuller, part of the reason for that was that the court was facing a docket crisis. And so, you know, much as we see with expansions of the court, this was an example where Congress sort of broke with precedent because it had practical considerations in mind that went beyond ideology. But all of the other examples of a nomination election year, either the seat was left open until for the next president to fill, or in a few cases, essentially the winner of the election was allowed to fill it. For example, Dwight Eisenhower made a recess appointment in October of 1956 after he wins the election, his recess appointment, William Brennan, was confirmed by the Senate Democrats. But by that point, Eisenhower had already won. So he was going to get to make a nomination anyway. In 1880, Rutherford B. Hayes sent up two nominations in the lame duck session, one of whom got confirmed, and the other was left open for his successor, James Garfield. But Hayes and Garfield were both Republicans. And so Senate opponents of Hayes couldn't really run out the clock and try to get the nomination to a different party. Same thing happened with John Tyler, who was essentially aligned with the Democrats in 1844. There were two open seats that were roadblocked by the Whigs all throughout 1844. In the lame duck session, with the Democrats having taken the White House and the Senate, they let one of Tyler's nominees through. Now, as far as the history, and so I would say that the historical norms and precedents for what Republicans have done recently on judicial nominees it's more or less in line with their actions in 2016 and 2020, even if admittedly it does sort of it reeks of a little bit of hypocrisy from Senate Republicans if you don't know the history. By contrast, if you look at the history of how we got to 9 Supreme Court justices, certainly there are partisan and ideological motivations along the way. If you look at the behavior of presidents in Congress between 1789 and 1869 in settling on 9 justice court. But at every turn where the court was expanded, there was a practical reason for doing so. We start with 6 justices in 1789. Again, the court, the Constitution didn't say how many justices. The Judiciary Act was created. There were 13 states at the time. It's a mark, perhaps, of, you know, we think of the founding fathers as very worldly men who thought of separation of powers and checks and balances, and they were, but they really were quite deluding themselves in one fashion, which was that they did not foresee that they themselves would split very rapidly into a two-party system. So they, I think we would agree that it was somewhat ridiculous in retrospect that they began with an even number of justices on the court. In 1801, when the Federalists had been routed out of the White House and the Senate, at that time, John Adams puts John Marshall on the court. One of the other things the Federalists did was they attempted to reduce the size of the court from 6 to 5. And the Democrats, when they came in, repealed that immediately. They recognized that it was a bad idea. That was going too far. But in 1807, near the end of the term, and near the end of Thomas Jefferson's term, the Democrats expanded the court to 7 justices. Now, there's 2 practical reasons for this, really. And by the way, just if you're a history buff on these things, the seat they created in 1807 is the one that was just filled by Justice Barrett. And there were 2 reasons for this. One is, again, that the court was evenly divided. But the other is that they needed, at that time, the court needed to expand with the size of the country because the justices rode circuit. We did not have, in fact, federal courts of appeal. And so appeals had to be heard by Supreme Court justices actually traveling to the different states. And so you have a new circuit created, what's essentially now the 6th Circuit, because there was no Supreme Court justice to ride out to Ohio, Tennessee, and Kentucky. It would have to be somebody who was already responsible for the East Coast doing it. And so is there an ideological motivation for the Democrats here? Of course, Thomas Jefferson was very much at loggerheads with John Marshall at this time. He had refused to even send a lawyer to argue Marbury versus Madison. And so Jefferson is happy to add a new justice to the court. As it turned out, he was not very successful in undermining Marshall's rather iron control of the court. But there is this reason. And so when you have their additional battles, you begin to have real partisan battles over the court in the 1820s and the 1830s. A new generation of Democrats come in, led by Andrew Jackson, who are also at odds with Marshall. Marshall finally dies in 1835 and is replaced by Roger Taney, who goes on to write the Dred Scott opinion. Taney had actually originally been Jackson's attorney general. He was nominated for the court and shot down. Then the Democrats take control of the Senate and they put him in as chief. In March of 1837, Jackson's on his way out the door, and the Democrats expand the court again from 7 to 9 justices. On the very last day of Jackson's term, he gets 2 guys confirmed, although one of them declines to serve, and Van Buren Jackson's successor replaces him. But again, you have to remember that at this point, while there are ideological motivations, the size of the country had increased from 14 to 26 states in between 1807 and 1837. And so there was still a real practical need to expand the size of the court because it was still riding circuit. And in fact, the court, as it turned out, the court in the 1850s would face a real legitimacy crisis, derived in part from the Jacksonian justices because of the Dred Scott decision, which involved a certain amount of not only creative misinterpretation of the Constitution, but also some rather direct collusion between the court and President Buchanan. And I'll try to wrap up here in a minute and get to the questions. But where we went from the 1850s, essentially, the court was expanded once more to 10 justices in 1863 in the middle of the Civil War. And this is, again, during a time of essentially a tug of war between Lincoln and Taney. But again, by this point, we're up to 36 states. The new justice who's appointed, who's actually a Democrat, Stephen Field, is a Californian. And so Lincoln is adding a new justice to deal with the fact that there was a West Coast and there was nobody could be responsible for riding circuit on the West Coast and also riding circuit on the East. Field actually stayed in California for a couple of months. After his appointment, he conducted a treason trial out there, which is a fascinating story in its own right. But after the war, in the radical Republicans are at odds with Andrew Johnson, they actually reduced the court to 7 in order to prevent Johnson from appointing any justices. So this is the point where we actually have something that really does look like court packing, except in reverse. And this is at the same time that they impeach Johnson. It's really inseparable from the Civil War, however. And I think history, even though historians are mostly pretty sympathetic these days to the radical Republicans in policy terms and what they wanted to do compared to Johnson on Reconstruction, I think that the historical judgment on their judgment of separation of powers and constitutional issues has been rather harsh. That even the impeachment itself, rather than impeach Johnson over something that was legitimately impeachable ground, they tried to throw him out for firing a cabinet secretary, which clearly the president has the constitutional power to do. But as soon as Johnson is out of the way, in 1869, the Judiciary Act is passed to set the court back to 9 justices. And perhaps fittingly, one of the seats that was created in that act is now held by Clarence Thomas. And ever since 1869, the court has remained at a steady 9. Justice Ginsburg only in the summer of 2019 said that she thought 9 was a good number and should be adhered to. Between 1869 and 1891, the Congress gradually abolished the whole practice of circuit riding. And therefore really got rid of any practical reason to have the court continue to expand with the country. The only practical argument in favor of expanding the court would be the idea that the court today is unable to handle its docket. And I don't think there's really any evidence of that. The court has, in fact, reduced its docket from what it was, say, 40 years ago. But I think if you look at the ways in which the court has really improved the quality of its work product. If you go back and read opinions from the 70s, the court is much more careful today about what it does. And I think that care reflects an appropriate balance between the number of justices in the docket. And if you doubled the court's docket and doubled the court's size, you would ultimately then end up with a lot of justices who are kind of falling in line rather than actually conducting their own independent analysis. So I think with that, we are far enough into the hour. Let me take, I don't know, Chad, did you want to read some of the questions, pick questions, or should I just kind of sort of plow through here?
Sure, I'll read the first question. First question is, if there is a 50-50 split, How likely do you think it is that Senators Manchin and Sinema hold the line against blowing up the filibuster and against court packing? And what does the 2022 Senate map look like in terms of DRR pickups that might affect such votes?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, Arizona, I think, is enormously important because it's not only Sinema, but you now have Mark Kelly, a newly elected Arizona senator who, you know, because he was elected in the special election, he'll be up again in the fall of 2022. And if the Democrats were to take the two Georgia Senate seats, one of those is also going to be up in the fall of 2022. And although that would be Raphael Warnock, is the Democrat running for that. And Warnock, I think, is probably less, you know, he I think, would be much more willing to go along with court packing. But I believe Kelly was, in fact, opposed to court packing on the trail. I'm just going mentally through my list. There were a number of other Democrats who were who bailed on court packing on the trail, but almost all of them lost. So they are less of a factor, candidates in Iowa and whatnot. I have to say, as a conservative, I would not terribly want to trust the fates, the fate of the court, to how much willingness there is in the Senate to, of key senators to buck their own party. I mean, I do think that some of the pressure for court packing, the greatest pressure for court packing, I think, would depend on what the court does. I think there will be less pressure for court packing if the issue comes up, as it will, after the court has declined to throw out Obamacare, which it is almost certainly, it's almost certainly not going to throw out Obamacare. It might strike down the individual mandate by itself, but that's not going to accomplish anything. There are other issues that I think might push them. Obviously, there would be certain, hullabaloo about this if the court does get around to striking down Roe versus Wade or doing something on, say, voting rights had there been a disposition of the 2020 election by the court, which I think is quite unlikely at this point, that would have built some pressure for that, but obviously it would only build pressure for that if they decided in favor of Trump, and at that point the Democrats would no longer be in a position to do anything about it.
The next question is somewhat related, and it's, do you think ending the Senate filibuster would be a big mistake?
I do, and I think, I think we're entering another hour for that discussion in full, but the short answer, first of all, the Democrats got rid of the filibuster for appellate judges, which they had been the first ones to really use anyway, in 2013. And there were lots of warnings from conservatives that they would live to regret this, and they disregarded them. And they did live to regret it, because Republicans then retaliated by taking that example to Supreme Court justices. And I think in the long run, I've never been a fan of the filibuster for nominees. I think we have an adequate system for nominations, and the president should get to have a vote on those when there is a majority in favor of confirming them. But the legislative filibuster is a different matter. And I think Democrats would eventually live to regret that as well. But there's no question that conservatives, I think, benefit more than liberals or progressives do from the filibuster. It does act as something of a sobriety check on the passage of new permanent legislation and new permanent entitlements, many of which are very, very difficult once they're in there to repeal.
I'm going to take moderator's privilege and ask a question of my own. Assuming the Republicans win both the Georgia seats and we're at 52-48, do you see any scenario in which a Republican Senate would confirm a Biden nominee to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, that's, I think, the big question about norms, right? Because as I've, for the reasons I've laid out, I think that the Republicans had an entirely defensible position in saying, we can force you to wait in a presidential election year, or we can get our own guy through in a presidential election year. And I think that Republicans could use their majority, say, to temporarily delay. I mean, if it is, for example, September of 2022, and Biden puts up a nominee, and Republicans say, you know what, we'd like to delay this until after the midterm. That would be a break with precedent. That's never been done before. But it would be at least sort of quasi-defensible as an argument that, look, we're just, you know, we're going to push this out a few months. But the reason, I mean, other than the Andrew Johnson example that I talked about, nobody has ever roadblocked nominations to the court for just years on end, right? That's just, it has never happened. So that would be a drastic new step. I don't think they would do it. I think there is unquestionably going to be some Republican sentiment for doing that. And some people who are maybe looking down the road at running for president, which is, you know, I mean, there's probably 30 or so of those in the Senate caucus, you know, who would not want to have their names associated with voting for a nominee. But I think ultimately, from McConnell's perspective and the perspective of the people at the margins of his caucus, he would much rather be in a position to just say to Biden, you know what, if you send us somebody bad, we'll shoot them down. And you'll get your second choice, or we'll, you know, we'll delay, we'll ask for concessions, we'll do something else, but we're not going to hold a seat on the court open for 3 years in a row. I think that's the point. If Republicans cross that bridge, it does become harder to resist court packing, you know, when the Democrats are eventually holding the whip hand someday.
Next question is, I've always been impressed by your facility for historical parallels in your writing and tweeting. Do you have any recent or lesser known history books you recommend?
Oh, there's a lot of that. There's a lot of that. I mean, all sorts of things. I mean, I guess the book I'm reading at the moment is Roy Jenkins's biography of William Gladstone, which is actually interesting for a whole another reason. Gladstone is you know, if you think of like sort of the Never Trump Republicans or the pro Remain Tories in Britain who are kind of isolated from their party, his biography is a little bit of that, and he turns around and ends up leading the other party. You know, there's also another one that I read recently that was really fascinating. It's outside the American history area, is Toby Green's book Fistful of Shells, which is about the history of West Africa. Really fascinating stuff, but there's a lot of different stuff out there.
I think this will be our last question, and it's from Professor Silverstein, who prefaces it by noting that he's a liberal law professor at the University of Arkansas, Little Rock, but we always enjoy Professor Silverstein joining our conversations and weighing in. Professor Silverstein says, I agree with your analysis of court packing, including your carefully crafted definition of court packing, which is essentially changing the structure of the Supreme Court to achieve a partisan advantage. The partisan advantage part of the definition is critical. I'm a strong supporter of Supreme Court reform, but not packing. I want very much to change the structure, such as by instituting term limits or changing the size, but I want to do so in a nonpartisan way, in a way that isn't designed to benefit one side or the other in the long term, but rather to address some of the problems with the existing system. For example, justices choosing to retire when a president is in office who agrees with them, effectively giving a justice two life terms rather than one. While you are clearly against packing, as am I, are you sympathetic to any reforms that are not designed to provide a clear advantage to one side or the other?
Yeah, I mean, one of my views of, you know, one of the things I've stuck to for years now as far as political writing is to never spend a lot of time proposing things that very obviously will just never ever get enacted because they require both sides to work together to give advantage only to one. You know, so I think that any reform of the court would have to be something that gives little something to both sides. I mean, the most urgent problem that is a real problem that we don't have a solution for at all with the court. And we've edged up to the limits of this with Justice Field in the late 19th century and Justice Douglas in the 1970s, is the problem of what you do when you have a member of the court who is just clearly physically or mentally unable to continue. I think it was during the 1820s or so, there was literally a Supreme Court justice who was institutionalized in an insane asylum for about a year. Which I guess is just as well that he wasn't writing opinions from there. But that to me is the most urgent thing that I would think you should be able to get bipartisan consensus on, something like a 25th Amendment for the court, where there's some process that has some semblance of institutional credibility and bipartisan credibility for determining when a justice is no longer able to serve. I mean, prospectively, I think at a minimum, I think it would be a good thing to institute an age limit at 80. I think if you were going to try to do that now, you would have to have some sort of grandfather clause that says, look, you know, anybody who's on the court currently, including Justice Breyer, is the only current member of the court who's over 80, you know, won't be forced off the court for another 10 years or so by this. I mean, I guess we have two justices now over 70, right? Because Thomas is 72. I think Alito is 70 or 71 now. He's older than you think. But I do think that there are some areas where, in theory, you could have bipartisan agreement enough to be able to get something. I mean, I think you would have to couple some of those things with an amendment that says nine justices is it. Probably, but I do think that on the whole, if you were going to try to get a constitutional amendment through, you would want to have, you know, a set of reforms that are not drastic, and that work around the edges of particular problems at the court. While I get the idea that some people have for sort of fundamental restructuring and, you know, the 18-year term limits and all of that, I don't think that we're ever going to be in a position where you could get that passed, because it's always going to obviously gore the ox of one side or the other.
Thank you very much, Dan. We really appreciate your time and appreciate you speaking with us today. And that was all for today, and I hope to see many of you on December 14th. Thank you very much for your time.
And thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you.